We are continuing in our Advent series this morning through the book of Ruth, and we have been taking a look at how this little short book, and even though it's in the Old Testament, really is it's a Christmas story. And we've been seeing that mostly through these parallels that we see in both stories. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the parallels of Ruth and Mary and these incredible examples of obedience and faith in God in their journeys. Last week we looked at the examples of Boaz and Joseph and the examples of what a righteous person looks like and these acts of kindness and protection and putting God first. It hasn't just been through the circumstances of these two stories, largely taking place in Bethlehem. It's been through the characters themselves. And today, we're going to look at another parallel, another thing that we kind of see in these two stories together as we look at the fact that the book of Ruth is also the story of of one who redeemed his beloved from a desperate situation at great personal cost to himself. And that is most definitely something that could be also used to describe the Christmas story. So far, as we've gone through this, we have been introduced to the three main characters of the book of Ruth. We first met Naomi, who was where the story of Ruth started, and we saw how Naomi and her husband Elimelech and their two sons traveled from Bethlehem to Moab to escape the famine that was happening there in Bethlehem, and it was not without tragedy because, right in the first few verses of this story, we see that Naomi loses her husband, Elimelech, while they're there. But not all hope is lost because she still has two sons who marry two Moabite women. One of them is the second main character of the story, the namesake of the book, Ruth. Ruth marries one of Naomi's sons. But again, tragedy strikes as Naomi's two sons also die, and so Naomi and Ruth and a third, Orpah, are left as widows. Well, eventually the news comes to Naomi that the famine in Bethlehem has ended, and so she makes the journey back, ultimately with her daughter-in-law Ruth, as they come back to Bethlehem at the end of the famine. Enter this third character, Boaz. Ruth and Naomi not only come to Bethlehem with the hope of the news that the famine has ended, they come to evidence that the famine has ended. Because as we looked at last week, they came at the beginning of the harvest. That's a pretty good sign that the famine has ended. If there's grain to harvest, that means there's food. And so they come back at the beginning of the harvest. And one day, Ruth decides to take advantage of a provision in the law for the poor and foreigners, and she goes out to glean on the edge of one of these fields. And it just happens to be, Boaz's field. And so we see in that, we see as this plays out also, that this is not just a Christmas story, it's not just a nice tale, it's also a love story. It's a Hallmark movie. It's better than a Hallmark movie. Although there are fitting things, you know, girl leaves town, comes back, falls in love with the guy who's there. It's the same. I mean, I think Hallmark stole the idea from the story of Ruth and just keeps telling it over and over again. Which I guess if you're going to steal a story from someplace, the Bible is probably a good place to take it. But we see through all of this wonderful example that we see of the promise in Romans 8:28, how God he works all of these things together for the good of those that love him. And we know that Ruth loves God because she's committed herself. Boaz loves God because we see that in his story. And he kind of providentially, maybe doesn't cause the events, but he works through them to bring Ruth and Boaz together. And we find out that Boaz is a guy that's worth meeting because he offers this kindness and protection and care for Ruth while she's harvesting in his fields. So chapter 2 last week kind of ended on a happy note. Boy meets girl. And the only way that it could have ended better was with a happy ending. Boaz and Ruth get married. They live happily ever after. Except that's not how chapter 2 ends. Instead, we hear this. And all the while, she, Ruth, lived with her mother-in-law. So the guy doesn't get the girl. The guy doesn't end up, they don't end up getting married. How is this all going to end? Well, we're only halfway through the story, so we haven't hit the happy ending part yet. And as with most love stories, there's some twists and turns here. There are there's some things that have to, some obstacles that you have to get over. It's never a straight line. As with most journeys in life, there are some ups and downs and things you have to go through before you get to the happy ending. The harvest season has ended, and Ruth and Boaz, while they have met, still have not come together. So chapter 2 ends kind of as almost as a TV show would, with a season-ending cliffhanger. How is all of this going to work out? How is this love story going to come together? How are Ruth and Boaz finally going to end up together? And what we're going to need is a big plot twist for this to happen. And that's exactly what we get in chapter 3. We get this big, daring, bold, breathtaking plot twist that no one could have seen coming. So we're gonna jump into chapter 3 and kind of walk through this the same way we have for the first two chapters of this story. But what we find really at the beginning of chapter 3 is what has been happening in Naomi's life this whole time. Ruth and Naomi are in a desperate situation. Yes, God has provided for them. Boaz has been generous to them, but it's kind of been situational. It's been you know, an event of generosity. What Ruth and Naomi need is something a little bit more permanent. Their greatest need is for Ruth to marry. Unless she marries, the two of them are always going to be in a precarious position. And if she doesn't marry, neither one of them, we're assuming because she had adult sons, Naomi is well along in her life now, that neither one of them are going to have children. They're not going to have a son to carry on the family name. And so desperate situations call for desperate measures. And Naomi comes up with a plan, this shocking plan, that really just underscores the heaviness and the weight of their desperate situation that they are in. So we're going to pick this up in chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. One day Naomi said to Ruth, "My daughter, it's time that I found a permanent home for you so that you will be provided for. Boaz is a close relative of ours, and he's been very kind by letting you gather grain with his young women. Tonight he will be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Now do as I tell you. Take a bath and put on perfume and dress in your nicest clothes. Then go to the threshing floor, but don't let Boaz see you until he has finished eating and drinking. Be sure to notice where he lies down, then go and uncover his feet and lie down there. He will tell you what to do." "I will do everything you say," Ruth replied. So she went down to the threshing floor that night and followed the instructions of her mother-in-law. So this is Naomi's brilliant plan. She's going to send Ruth to Boaz in the middle of the night down at the threshing floor to lie down at his feet and then suffer whatever comes next. It's a desperate plan. It's a reckless plan. Kids, they're out there, don't try this at home. Naomi's situation is so desperate, she is willing to, she's risking everything, not only for her, but for Ruth, by asking her to do this. And she's doing it in the hopes that it will finally bring Ruth and Boaz together as husband and wife. Now, this whole plan to us sounds, it sounds weird. But it's not as if Naomi is doing this blindly. She knows a lot of stuff that we don't necessarily know. She knows a lot of the situation that she's sending Ruth into. And it gives her a glimmer of hope. She knows that Boaz is a kinsman or a close relative of her deceased husband, Elimelech. Now, you might remember last week we talked about this a little bit when Ruth came to Naomi and told her whose field she was gleaning in or harvesting in. Naomi knew the name right away. She said, "The Lord bless him. This man is one of our closest relatives, one of our kinsmen redeemers." The New Living Translation says family redeemer, but I like the term. I like the term kinsman, so we're going to use that. So what is a kinsman redeemer? Some of you might have heard that term before, but you're not familiar with what it is. Well, a kinsman redeemer is basically this: a close relative who is responsible to help a family member out in their time of need. Now, we hear a lot about the responsibilities of the kinsman redeemer all throughout the Pentateuch, especially in three books. The Pentateuch, first five books of the Bible, we hear about it in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And essentially, the responsibilities were varied depending on the situation. One of them was if a family member became poor and had to sell off their land or sell off their property, the kinsman redeemer would be one who would be responsible for buying that property back for their family member. They were responsible to buy back family members who had been sold into slavery, or to avenge the killing of a close family member. And then there was the special situation, which we are encountering here in the book of Ruth, the case of a widow who had no children. In this case, the man's brother, or as it went down the line, was to marry the widow, and the first son she bore to him would carry on the name and estate, basically, of the dead brother, so that his name would not be blotted out from Israel. What Naomi is hoping is that Boaz will be this kinsman redeemer for Ruth by marrying Ruth so that the family name will continue. So essentially what she is doing in sending Ruth to the threshing floor and telling her to clean up, put on perfume, put on your best clothes, is she is preparing her as a bride. Ruth washes and she perfumes herself. She puts on her best clothes, and then she leaves for the threshing floor. Now, if you don't know what the threshing floor was, it was just a place where when they harvested the grain, they separated the wheat from the chaff. That was basically, and it was kind of, it was a storage facility too for the grain. So we pick this story up again in verse 7. After Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he lay down at the far end of the pile of grain and went to sleep. Then Ruth came quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Around midnight, Boaz suddenly woke up and turned over. He was surprised to find a woman lying at his feet. No kidding. So after a long day of work, of harvesting, and a hearty supper, Boaz lays down for the night to go to sleep on the threshing floor. And he's sleeping on the threshing floor because they didn't have fancy, you know, you couldn't lock the threshing floor. The landowners would stay with their grain to make sure nobody came and stole it. And so that's why he's spending the night on the threshing floor. Now, Ruth has been watching, kind of hiding out, seeing all this play out, following her mother-in-law's instructions, which is a miracle in itself. That was supposed to be funnier than it was. Maybe the relationships between mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws was different in ancient Israel. But she's following all these instructions. And once she sees that Boaz is asleep, and maybe anybody else who's around there, she sneaks in to the threshing floor, very quietly uncovers his feet, lays down, and waits. And sometime in the middle of the night, the scripture tells us at midnight, Boaz is startled awake by something. Maybe it's the fact that he knows his feet aren't covered up. How many of you have ever woken up in the middle of the night because your feet weren't under the blanket? Yeah, there you go. I think Boaz is having a very relatable experience here. He knows his feet, there's something startles him awake. And then he's really startled because he realizes that there's a woman lying at his feet. And he asks the natural question: who are you? It's dark, so he's still coming out of it. And Ruth answers, "I am your servant, Ruth." And then she asks him to do something. Now, there's odd stuff throughout all this entire episode. And hopefully, as we'll go through this, the pieces will come together and make sense. But she asks him to do something very odd. She asks him to spread the corner of his covering or his blanket over her. Because as she says, "You are my family redeemer. You are my kinsman redeemer." Now, spreading the corner of your garment over someone, or a man spreading the corner of his garment over a woman, was a pledge of marriage. And in fact, that is a custom still practiced in parts of the Middle East today. So Ruth first identifies herself. I think she has a sense that once Boaz knows who she is, she's okay. He's treated her well so far. She identifies herself, and then she makes this audacious request. She is basically proposing marriage to Boaz, which was not the direction it was supposed to go. She asks him to fulfill his role as kinsman redeemer by spreading the corner of his garment over her with the protection and pledge of marriage. I don't know that we fully appreciate the situation that Ruth is in. I don't know that we fully appreciate the trust that she put in her mother-in-law by going through with this plan. Boaz could have responded in all sorts of different ways. If he was a dishonorable man, he could have taken advantage of her right there. And not only that, he could have also claimed it was her fault. "She seduced me in the middle of the night." Men had that kind of, we see that story of the group of men who brought the woman to Jesus to be stoned. Men had that kind of, they could convince other people. There were other harvesters sleeping nearby. He could have caused a scene and exposed her to disgrace and punishment, much the same way that Joseph could have done to Mary. Ruth and Naomi are in a desperate situation. So Ruth, she is risking everything here. By visiting Boaz in the middle of the night, she has thrown herself completely on the mercy of Boaz and his good character. So how does Boaz respond? Well, since we've already found a little bit out about Boaz, we know that he's a man of good reputation and a man of righteousness. And so he responds as you would expect him to respond. He responds with mercy and kindness and love and righteousness. Verses 10 through 13. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," Boaz exclaimed. "You are showing even more family loyalty now than you did before, for you have not gone after a younger man, whether rich or poor. Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary, for everyone in town knows you are a virtuous woman. But while it's true that I'm one of your family redeemers, there is another man who is more closely related to you than I am. Stay here tonight, and in the morning I will talk to him. If he is willing to redeem you, very well, let him marry you. But if he is not willing, then as surely as the Lord lives, I will redeem you myself. Now lie down here until morning." Now Boaz is kind of showing a little bit of his hand here. You almost get the sense he knows that he's not the first in line. And you almost get the sense that he's kind of hoping a situation like this is going to present itself. Because he was ready to respond to Ruth. And so he tells her, I'm so thankful that it means so much to me that you have come to me and not gone when you could have gone to somebody else. He's touched that she would seek him out as a husband instead of a younger man. But Ruth doesn't want somebody else. She wants Boaz. One of the younger men might make a good husband, but they would not be the kinsman redeemer to carry on the family name. Boaz speaks kindly to her, as we've seen him do all through this story so far, and he promises that he will do all that she asks. But there's one hitch. There's another man who's a closer relative than Boaz. The other man has the first right of redemption. And Boaz is going to need to approach him first before he can do anything. And so Boaz doesn't want Ruth wandering home in the middle of the night with all sorts of, you know, get rumors started. And so he tells her to stay there until the morning where she'll be safe. Just make sure that nobody knows that she's been there. In verses 14 and 15, it says, "So Ruth lay at Boaz's feet until the morning. But she got up before it was light enough for people to recognize each other. For Boaz had said, 'No one must know that a woman was here at the threshing floor.' Then Boaz said to her, 'Bring your cloak and spread it out.' He measured out 6 scoops of barley into the cloak and placed it on her back. Then he returned to the town." So when morning comes, Boaz again, he showers her with his love and his provision and protection. He makes sure that she's safe going home. He makes sure that she has something to take back. She's up and out of there before anybody, even if they saw her, they wouldn't know who it was. And then he gives her these 6 scoops, these 6 measures of barley to bring back to Naomi, really as a token of good faith. As my word is good. Now, poor Naomi, you can just imagine she has probably not slept well. She's hoping and she's operating on the knowledge that she has of Boaz, but until she hears back from Ruth, she doesn't have any idea how this went. Maybe Ruth didn't even make it to the threshing floor. So she's waiting for Ruth to come back to give her news. And when Ruth returns, she immediately asks her how it went. And Ruth says in verse 17, "He gave me these 6 scoops of barley and said, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.' Then Naomi said to her, 'Just be patient, my dear, my daughter, my dear,'" you could say my dear as well, "'until we hear what happens. The man won't rest until he has settled things today.'" So Naomi, if you remember back in the beginning, Naomi had left Bethlehem full, went to Moab, and came back empty. And now God, through Boaz and through Ruth, is assuring her that she is not going to stay empty. She's not going to stay alone. She's not going to be forsaken. God has her. She doesn't know how all this is going to work out yet, but she's getting signs along the way that God has a plan. Naomi and Ruth risked everything in going to Boaz, and his loving response is the exact answer that they needed for their desperate situation. Now we come to chapter 4 and the actual redemption of Ruth and Naomi. And it's here that we learn all of the cost involved with this. Their redemption was a costly redemption, one that would involve great sacrifice on Boaz's part, as is evidenced by the reaction of the other kinsmen that Boaz approaches here. And we pick it up again in the beginning of chapter 4 and verse 1. "Boaz went to the town gate and took a seat there. Just then the family redeemer he had mentioned came by. So Boaz called out to him, 'Come over here and sit down, friend. I want to talk to you.' So they sat down together. Then Boaz called 10 leaders from the town and asked them to sit as witnesses. And Boaz said to the family redeemer, 'You know Naomi, who came back from Moab. She's selling the land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should speak to you about it so that you can redeem it if you wish. If you want the land, then buy it here in the presence of these witnesses. But if you don't want it, let me know right away, because I am next in line to redeem it after you.' The man replied, 'All right, I'll redeem it.'" So Boaz meets this other kinsman, this other redeemer, at the town gate, along with 10 of the town's elders. Now, the significance of that is the town gate was a place where transactions and legal things happen, much like a city hall. And the elders served as legal witnesses to anything that would happen. And so Boaz, he's not wanting to leave any stone unturned here. He wants to make sure he does due diligence. He's going through this whole thing. And so he addresses the kinsman redeemer and says, hey, Naomi's selling this land. You have the first right to redeem it. If you want to, do it today. If not, I will. And the answer that he gets on the surface doesn't appear that things are going to go the way Boaz had planned. But notice, Boaz leaves out part of the story. Notice what he doesn't mention here. He hasn't said a word about Ruth. He's being a little sneaky. Maybe he's exercising with bees, wise as serpents. Maybe that's what he's exercising here. The land is not the main thing. In fact, I think Boaz would have been perfectly fine to not get the land if he could get the other half. He wants to marry Ruth, but first he needs to establish before witnesses, before the town elders in an official setting, that if the nearer relative will not fulfill his role as the kinsman redeemer, then Boaz is more than ready to do it. He mentions the land first, and then the kinsman redeemer says, I will redeem it. Not so fast, Boaz says. And in verse 5, he goes, then Boaz told him, of course, your purchase of the land from Naomi also requires that you marry Ruth, the Moabite widow. That way she can have children who would carry on her husband's name and keep the land and the family. Then I can't redeem it, the family redeemer replied, because this might endanger my own estate. You redeem the land, I cannot do it. So Boaz just blows up the whole thing. When Naomi's husband died, and it can be a complicated situation, just as legal things do with inheritance and estates are now, it can be a complicated situation. When Naomi's husband died, everything they owned passed on to the sons. Well, now both sons are dead. So technically it falls into the hands right now of Naomi and Ruth. Orpah decided not to come back from Moab, and so she's kind of out of she's removed herself from the picture. If the man really wants to fulfill the role of kinsman redeemer, he's going to have to also marry Ruth, the Moabite. And notice how Boaz adds that little fact in there, the Moabite widow. Well, that is a different matter entirely. This man, it doesn't say, but I imagine he probably did not want to marry a Moabite. But not only that, marrying Ruth would endanger his own estate. We don't know if he has children. It doesn't give us any of those details. But if Ruth bears a son, that son would be bound to Naomi's family. And then if something were to happen to his own children, then everything that he owns, ultimately his entire estate, would be transferred to Naomi and ultimately Ruth. It's costly. And he's not willing to pay the price. So he tells Boaz, I can't do it. You redeem it yourself. And in verses 7 and 8, we get insight into a very interesting legal process that they engaged in. Now, in those days, it was the custom in Israel for anyone transferring a right of purchase to remove his sandal and hand it to the other party. This publicly validated the transaction. So the other family redeemer drew off his sandal, as he said to Boaz, you buy the land. Now, again, this is one of those kind of confusing ancient customs that I have no idea how to explain, other than possibly, and this is just immediately where my mind went. It was a symbol of God's promise to Joshua God made a promise to Joshua that everywhere he set his foot would be his. And this is almost symbolic in the sense that to give your sandal was to give up the right to set the right to be able to set your foot on that piece of land. And when this guy took off his sandal, he forfeited all his rights to not only the land, but to Ruth. He forfeited his right as the kinsman redeemer. That right passed on to Boaz as the next in line, and Boaz does not waste any time enforcing it. Verses 9 and 10. Then Boaz said to the elders and to the crowd standing around, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. And with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown. You are all witnesses today." So Boaz doesn't even go to Ruth, doesn't go to Naomi to give him the good news. He wants to make sure he's actually got good news in place to go deliver to them. And so he doesn't waste any time. He doesn't want to let anybody else try to step in or do something to him in the meantime. We don't know if there might have been somebody else who would have been willing to step in, but Boaz doesn't waste any time stepping into this role as Ruth's kinsman redeemer. And it was costly. We know he had property. We know he had people who worked for him. We know that he was a man of means. We know that he had enough to where he could just give generously to someone. And so this was a risk that Boaz was taking. It was a major risk, as we see in what the other kinsman redeemer was not willing to do. He backed out of the deal. But Boaz loved Ruth. He apparently didn't mind marrying a Moabite. And he was willing to pay the price to do so. And remember, the book of Ruth it's a love story. It's a story of a kinsman redeemer who redeemed his beloved from a desperate situation at great cost to himself. The Christmas story is also a love story. And wouldn't you know it, it is also the story of a kinsman redeemer who redeemed his beloved from a desperate situation at great cost to himself. And if you're wondering who the beloved is in that situation, it's us. We are the beloved. We are the ones who have found ourselves in a desperate situation that we have no way on our own to get out of. Paul describes his situation in Galatians 3. We were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. We were prisoners of sin. We were the ones who were locked in a situation we could not get out of. We were the ones who were waiting for someone to come and redeem us. We were lost in our sins, cut off from God. We were desperate and in need of a redeemer. And how did God respond to our desperate situation? Paul goes on in Galatians 4 to say, "But when the right time came," you notice Boaz didn't move until the right time came. We wonder, you know, they say God's never late. But I just heard somebody say this the other day and it stuck with me. God's never late, but man, he is last minute sometimes. I'm sure that's what it felt like to Ruth and Naomi. "God, we know you're going to move. Hurry up." But you notice Boaz, at the right time. God, at the right time. time, sent his son, born of a woman, subject to the law. Boaz was subject to the law. He followed all of the necessary steps, all of the necessary procedures. God sent him to buy freedom for us who are slaves to the law so that he could adopt us as his very own children. Boaz redeemed Ruth as his very own with all of the privileges and rights that came to belonging to Boaz. God came and redeemed us to adopt us as sons and daughters with all of the rights and privileges that come with being a child of God. God's loving response was what we celebrate at Christmas. We don't tend to, and we've got to be careful because Jesus does have a whole life to live. But we do know that's why he came. It's not just, oh, this sweet little baby is born in a manger. Yeah, that's nice. And it was. It was a beautiful, the birth of a child is beautiful. But what that child came to do was not cheap. It was not easy. And it ultimately cost him everything. God sent his son. Jesus, the eternal Son of God, was born into our world as a human being. You realize when Boaz redeemed Ruth, he kind of took on some of that Moabiteness. To some in the around him, he was a little stained. You're marrying this foreign enemy. Yeah, I know your relative ran off and married her off there, but we don't, He became like us. He became kin with us. He was born of a woman, born under the law to redeem those under the law, to make us his very own sons and daughters. Jesus is our kinsman redeemer. He became our kinsman redeemer, and it was a costly redemption. In Mark 10:45, we read, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life," not to pull out of his coffers or pull out of his savings account, "to give his life as a ransom for many." Just as Boaz didn't ultimately serve himself, but served Ruth and Naomi, so Jesus came not to be served, but to serve. And it cost him dearly. You realize it cost him far more than it ever cost Boaz. The other kinsman redeemer was worried about risking his estate. Jesus left his estate. Just left it. To come here. To be one of us. And when he came here, he did not come with the amenities that we have. He was born in a barn. He was born among livestock. He was laid in straw. And the comforts that he experienced in his estate, you think of the most comfortable situation you've been in your life? Not even close. We're going to one day experience the comforts that he's experienced in his estate because of what he's done. But it cost him far more than it ever cost Boaz. He left his estate for us. He left the glories of heaven. He came to earth, entered our world as a human being. He was forsaken by his Father. He gave his life. Ours was a costly redemption. Jesus is our kinsman redeemer. But just like Ruth, our redemption is not automatic. We need to come to Jesus for salvation. just as Ruth recognized her need and she understood when Naomi laid it all out there, here's what I need you to do. She recognized her own desperate situation and she cast herself completely on the mercy and goodness of Boaz and on his love. We have to recognize our own desperate situation and cast ourselves completely on the mercy and grace and love of Jesus. And just as Boaz did not cast Ruth away, he responded lovingly to her. Jesus gives us his promise in John 6. Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. Christmas is the story of a kinsman redeemer who redeemed his beloved from a desperate situation at the ultimate cost to himself. Jesus is that kinsman redeemer.